Working Cows Podcast, Episode 85.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. We are now officially transitioned over there. So as I posted on Facebook this week, if I broke anything, if you're having to go somewhere you're not used to find this, please reach out to me, workingcows.net/contact, or hit me up on the Facebook page and let me know. A couple of other things I want to get to before we get going with this episode with Cody Creelman is that at the globalagnetwork.com website, you now have the opportunity to set up a profile where you can be notified when all the podcasts are members of the network, and there's new ones being added all the time, so I encourage you to check that out. You can set up a profile so that you get notified when those episodes go live of those podcasts that you have subscribed to through the network. So go over to globalagnetwork.com and check that out. Another thing is that this episode today was the result of a request. So I do take requests. I've got quite a big backlog of requests, but I do encourage people to engage. And here's a new way that we're going to do that right now is I want to encourage you to go ahead and give me a call. Call me at 605-549-5401, 605-549-5401, and leave me a voicemail and tell me about how you heard about the Working Cows podcast, whatever you want to, just call in and share, and I'm going to use that in future episodes. Maybe I'll just start playing those voicemails at the end of the episodes, whatever it is. Just call in, leave me a voicemail. Maybe it'll be voicemail roulette. Maybe it'll be everybody who leaves a voicemail gets played at the end of the show. Whatever it is, I want to start using some of that. So 605-549-5401 and leave me a voicemail, and I want to start engaging with you on that. Now, we're going to talk to Cody Creelman today, and we're going to talk to Cody about castration. As I said, requested by a listener, but hey, there's even some paradigm-challenging ways to think about castration, and Cody is a vet in Airdrie, Alberta, Canada, and he runs a bunch of different vet clinics. He's part of a conglomerate of vet clinics and kind of over that as well, and so he's doing some interesting things there. He's also a vlogger. There'll be a link to his most recent vlog up at the show notes page as well, but for now, suffice it to say, Cody knows what it's talking about when it comes to bovine testicles, and I appreciate Cody joining me today. Cody, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I invited you on because somebody asked me to have a discussion about castration, and you are the resident Working Cows vet, I guess, or at least the closest thing I've got to it. So I reached out to you, and you were willing, so here we are. So first of all, I guess we'll just start off with talking about why we even do castration in a commercial herd setting. What are the benefits of it? What are the reasons why people would do that?
For sure. So, you know, the first one is really just the cessation of male hormones. So men are really difficult to deal with, and typically when we change their mind, the common vet term is you change their mind from ass to grass, and then you have some animals that are easier to handle. So certainly from an animal handling standpoint, it has been, you know, that's one of the reasons. Now, you could make the argument that out until weaning, you're probably not going to have too many issues taking a, you know, a bull to 6 months of age. You're probably not going to notice any differences when it comes to cattle handling if you're a commercial cow-calf ranch, right? But that is one of the old sort of reasons that we talk about it. Another one is just kind of preventing the mating of genetically inferior stock, right? Just as a generalized statement, if we're only selecting for the best of the best by leaving a set of testicles in, then certainly we're hopefully are propagating superior genetics in our livestock. Avoiding price discounts in terms of the feedlots, that certainly is an issue. When you're looking at price discounts of bulls relative to steers, the number is quite variable, but typically I'll quote in between, you know, that 10 to 40 cents per pound in terms of a discount that exists out there in the market. That said, when you look at the data set, it's only about, what is it? I think it's only about 60% of commercial cow-calf producers in the U.S. are castrating before weaning time. So it's pretty amazing how, you know, that there's still 40% of animals that are running through a cow-calf system in the U.S. that do not get castrated. That's a lot of animals coming through there. But, you know, that's another reason that we do it on the cow-calf side, is we just want to avoid those price discounts. They are real. They do exist. And then the other reasons that I really believe lie in from a feedlot perspective, not necessarily from a commercial cow-calf perspective.
Right. So what time of year do you typically see people castrating? I mean, what are the majority? That 40% statistic is pretty interesting to me. So I'll just throw out everything I think I know about castration and ask you a really obvious question. When do you usually see people castrating?
So in my practice area, the typical time right now is birth. So the more common, I would say, in that 75% range of people who castrate prior to weaning, 75% would be doing it right at birth. They would be doing an elastrator band castration would be the most common within my area. And then the rest of them would be doing a surgical castration at branding time, which is typically 6 weeks of age.
So where I'm at, that's the norm, is the surgical castration at branding time. I've not been around anybody who does it at birth that I know of. So is there any sacrifice of the male hormones and growth when you castrate at birth, or are you not gaining that benefit until much later, even after branding time or whatever?
Yeah, you're actually not even really gaining that right out until weaning time. So there's been quite a few studies that have looked at, you know, comparing those castrates to intact animals right on out. But I'll point one, you know, to one study looking at animals that were castrated at birth, and then those animals that were castrated at 2 months of age, and their average daily gain only differed by 0.1 pounds per day difference, and it wasn't statistically significant. So you don't have a difference in that weaning weight by doing it then. And even the literature on doing it, doing it right out to weaning time, it's not conclusive that you're really getting that great of a return on gain by leaving those nuts in even out to weaning time. Those animals, especially in later maturing breeds, animals that aren't hitting puberty till later, they're really not getting the benefit out of having those testicles.
Very interesting. So in your context, are people generally calving through a barn and they're touching every animal in any ways, so they would be doing that, or how does that look?
Yeah, I would say for the most part in my geography, there is some level of calf contact prior to the branding time. So they would be putting in at least a management tag, maybe an RFID tag up here in Canada, and some producers would be giving a vitamin or selenium shot. And then also some producers who have had some issues with pre-branding time pneumonia may also be giving an intranasal modified live viral vaccine. That would be pretty common, that anybody calving from January, you know, the purebred producers right through into April typically would be running them through some sort of calving handling system, getting dry off on those calves, pairing them up and then sending them out to their nurse pasture. So they are getting touched.
Yeah. And so what's the risk of missing a testicle with an elastrator that at birth? Is it pretty easy to find both nuts and make sure you've got them both, or how does that look?
If you can count to two, you should be able to do it without any sort of complications. So there has been also literature on looking at complication rates and mortality and morbidity, so some sickness in between castrating with bands at branding time. So that's still a thing that happens sometimes, is guys will do a band castration at branding time. There's no statistical difference in anything in terms of morbidity, mortality, complication rates, missing testicles when you're comparing the two. When we look at the data, there is no difference. Anecdotally, certainly there is things that we can talk about and why that, so maybe that myth exists. When I talk to the feed yards, when they're dealing with a group of what we call belly nuts, so essentially a single retained testicle, there's a scrotal ablation, so there's no scrotum. One testicle is missing, but we do find a pretty high percentage of animals that do have a testicle that is a belly nut, so not an abdominal testicle, but just along the surface of the skin. The feedlot cowboys are convinced this is an implant strategy that the cow-calf guys are using, where they're pushing one nut up purposefully, not on accident, and then castrating and getting the benefit of that hormone, but not getting docked at weaning time. Now, nobody would ever do that, would they?
I don't know. That sounds like some Alex Jones-level conspiracy stuff to me.
You can't handle the truth.
Yeah, this nut was an inside job.
Yes,
that was absolutely a terrible pun. I'm sorry.
So they truly believe that. When you look at the feedlot side, they can't understand why they're cutting so many belly nuts on arrival or at processing, a secondary processing. So they've convinced themselves of this old school implant technique. But if we're just talking about how hard is it to actually do the technique, it's exactly as I mentioned. If you can count to two, you'll make sure that everything's fine. Now, there is some considerations to that. You do want to make sure that your equipment is in proper working condition. Like, you don't want to be using those green elastrator bands. If they're cracked, they have an expiry date on the bag. We don't want to use them past expiration. So there's considerations that we have to make that, yeah, there can be issues if we're using improper equipment or expired bands.
And if the bands have been sitting on the dash of your pickup, the expiration date does not apply anymore. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that goes also for darts as well, for treatment darts. If you leave it in the hot sun, your treatment, don't get mad when that Draxxin blasts out back at you.
Yeah, that's not a cheap mistake.
Exactly right.
Let's talk about retained nuts and complications within, and how to handle those complications within any kind of a castration system, whether it's elastrators or surgical removal. What are the complications as far as the physiology of the animal, and how should people handle those?
Yeah, so in terms of complications, so when it comes to band castration at birth, the typical complication would be that retained testicle, or legitimately you have a cryptorchid, so an undescended testicle. So that is a normal thing that happens in all species, that a certain percentage of animals legitimately only have one testicle that is down into the scrotal body that you can actually get a band around. So in those cases, you certainly want to identify them, tag them as intact, not banded, and you would just address that surgically at branding time. So then you would have this animal tagged and identified that you'll have to go perhaps digging for that retained testicle. That's truly the only complications when you're doing it at birth. I'm not saying that it's completely benign. When you're doing band castration at birth, there is inflammation around that ring site, but there is hardly ever any chance of infection or hemorrhage or any other complication when you're doing it that young. And from an animal welfare perspective, that is deemed the most animal welfare friendly way to castrate. When it comes to complications at branding time, there certainly can be some. So when we're going with surgical castration, hemorrhage is always an issue. So that's typically due to technique and how that surgical castration is done. Experience is certainly another one. So hemorrhage is certainly an issue. Once again, you can have a cryptorchid, you can have a retained testicle. That can be a complication that you have to decide, you know, is it worth digging or is it worth just leaving this nut in this calf and potentially getting docked for having a staggy animal, which is usually my preference. I think in most cases you wouldn't get docked, and it's probably better to leave that nut in than it is to risk that animal's life. And then infection. So infection is a big one for sure. Most of the infection can be mitigated through a couple different things. One is just hygiene. So actually wearing gloves and using, a clean scalpel and only touching the tissue that you're going to remove and never touching the tissue that's going to stay behind in the animal. So for example, you cut that nut out and then you stick your finger up inside that incision site, you've just contaminated tissue that's going to stay with that animal. Whereas your hand can be as dirty as you want holding that testicle, because you're going to cut that away and that's not going to lend itself to infection. So infection is an issue, but I think with proper technique and hygiene, it can be mitigated quite well.
So are people in Canada generally doing the elastrator bands because of the animal welfare concern? Is there a regulation that's in place or some kind of a discount that's placed on them at the sale barn because of a knife cut, or how does that?
Yeah, so I would say that it's kind of twofold as to why the band castration at birth is more popular up here. I think it's veterinary driven, so I think that's a common consulting thing that we talk about when people ask us what is our preferred method of castration, and when it comes to complications and when it comes to animal welfare, we push them in that direction, especially when there is no benefit in terms of growth physiology in that animal. So veterinary driven. And then I do also think that it is just somewhat been a cultural drift in terms of having skilled labor there to do surgical castration. That can be an issue. So if you can mitigate one less step of having the calf castrator at a branding, that's good. And then also just complications. So usually once they try it, they recognize that they didn't have that calf hemorrhage. They don't have castration site infections to deal with. So that's usually why they end up migrating to doing it at birth.
So when is it too late for a surgical removal? Is there a point? I know we talk about, hemorrhaging issues and different things like that with a more mature animal. What is there a timeline there that you would say it's too late for the surgical removal?
No. So I actually always prefer, so after banding at birth, in terms of what I prefer, is always surgical castration. So, we have the opportunity to band those animals at any time. But from an animal welfare consideration, I do prefer surgical castration by a skilled person using appropriate pain mitigation techniques. So given the option any day of the week, regardless of animal size, I would rather do a surgical castration, but there's a caveat to that. I'm using an epidural, I'm using a lidocaine testicular block, and I'm also using a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory for pain control. The reason that I picked that is band castration past birth can cause some long-standing, I wouldn't call it necessarily low-grade pain, but long-standing pain and inflammation. When you put a calicrate band on a 10-month-old bull, which is common procedure in a feed yard, it can take 30 days or longer for that scrotum to fall off, and there is some significant pain that exists with that. We've done lots of trials, even within my own practice, looking at animal intake, looking at pedometer data, so how much those animals move, and it's very clear at day 28 after band castration in a mature animal or a you know, a larger animal, at a day 28, that's typically when that band starts to really cut through that skin, and you can see that they're in pain. So I always prefer surgical castration. In Canada, we do have beef cattle codes of practice that exist that allow us to castrate an animal of any size, with the caveat that we have to provide pain mitigation for those animals when they're larger. So the original beef cattle code of practice was 9 months of age. So at 9 months of age, we were doing castration, we had to provide pain control. Now it's 6 months of age, so an animal that's getting castrated 6 months of age must get pain control. I'm happy to report, though, that in Canada, at least in my practice area, the vast majority of people who castrate outside of birth with the bands are using non-steroidal anti-inflammatory pain control. So almost every calf that gets surgically castrated in my practice, if they're 2 weeks old or 6 weeks old or 6 months old, are getting pain control.
How is that administered?
So the typical product that we use up here is either injectable or oral. So we have two options. The active ingredient is meloxicam. So this is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory that actually lasts about 3 days. So it has pretty good plasma concentrations, like longer standing plasma concentrations. We have two product options. One is oral, and those calves essentially are down and they're getting processed, and you have essentially a little small drench gun. The animal gets 3 mils per 100 weight, so typically 6 mils squirted in their mouth, and that'll provide them with 3 days of pain control. Now, that does not control the pain at the time of the procedure, but it is still considered to be pain mitigation for the procedure, because those animals will have a level of meloxicam in their system within the first 20 minutes of administration that will have an anti-inflammatory effect.
Sure. So just to give you a picture of the culture where I'm at, if I had to guess, and this is just my guess, I've been on a few operations, but not all of them, obviously. If I had to guess how this was going to be handled, most people are going to knife cut at branding time. And if they came across an animal that needed some attention after that, or got missed or whatever, and they were older, I can imagine that the solution, if they were going to knife cut, would be to rope head and heel, rope them, stretch them out, and knife cut them that way. But that would not be typical. What would typically be done with an animal that got missed, that was older, would be to run them through the chute and to band them. So right. It kind of sounds flip-flopped from what your experience is.
Well, interestingly, it has nothing to do with castration, but one of the amazing things that has also just happened culturally here is through the use of that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory in the bull calves at branding time that are getting surgically castrated. Producers up here actually started using it on all the animals. So they're using it even on their heifer calves just to control the pain of being roped and being processed. So they've noted a big difference in how quickly those animals pair up with moms post-branding, and how easy it is to move those animals out because the pairing up happens so much quicker because those calves aren't sore. So there's no literature, there's no data to back this up. It's just been something that's happened culturally, is guys just feel that it's so much easier to work with the calves post-branding processing event when they get a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. They think these calves are just kind of getting beat up, right? They get ran in, they're crowded up, they get roped, they get thrown. And sometimes they get hot iron branded. So even if they're not getting the nuts cut out of them, they're still sore, and people are really appreciating a noticeable benefit from how perky those calves seem after they're done the processing event, which has been fascinating. So now I have guys that don't even do surgical castration, but they do rope those calves and they do vaccinate them. Sometimes they'll hot iron brand them. They're not even doing a surgical castration, and they're still providing a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory to their entire branding group.
So can you talk about the cost associated with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the cost depends on the product that you want, and certainly it's always regional depending on the market, but it's typically around $1 to $2.
Dollar a head for the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, or up to $2.
Yeah, exactly, depending on, you know, which product, how big your calves are.
So I laid out the culture of my area as far as I understand it for you. Could you give me an argument basically against that, or point out some of the disadvantages of that and some of the advantages of doing it the way that you were talking about with banding at calving time?
For sure. So doing it surgically at a young age, I think, is an okay method. Certainly, producers love the assurance of being able to see two nuts on the ground and making sure that it was actually done. I think it is not an animal welfare issue if we are doing it, you know, quickly with a very well-trained, very skilled person doing the surgical technique. Commenting, I would love to see, you know, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory given to that situation. In the older animals, in terms of band castration, that is still very common up here as well, to do a calicrate band of band castration of a more mature animal. It decreases complications when it comes to, you know, an unskilled laborer doing it. So what I mean is, the reason that I think calicrate bands have become so popular for mature animals is just because they're more foolproof. It's more difficult to screw those up in comparison to doing a surgical castration of a larger animal. So it's just easier to do with less skilled labor, which is a situation that we see in a feedlot setting, right? It in some circumstances, it can be cleaner. So think of a really sloppy feedlot and you do a surgical castration. That said, when I'm doing surgical castrations, I'm never giving antibiotics either, even if they are going into a feedlot. So I think when it's a skilled person doing it, you're mitigating a lot of the risks. So overall, I think that is very typical, but if I could move the needle forward just in terms of the industry and animal welfare, I would love to see band castration when we have the opportunity. So I'm not saying that all of you guys need to then get your hands on those calves at birth, because that's just not part of your typical processing culture. If there's no need to touch those calves at birth, then there's no need to touch those calves at birth. And surgical castration at branding time is the next best option, I truly believe. But if you are processing those calves already, then I do think there is benefit to doing a band castration then.
With a surgical castration at branding time, you're talking about the anti-inflammatory being the maybe the one thing that we could do to kick up their recovery or help them to deal with that pain of the surgery process. So I guess that's kind of maybe one way we're challenging a paradigm here today, aside from the band castration at birth, is that people could maybe look at adding a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory to their protocol at branding time and could help with recovery.
Absolutely. But let's talk about challenging paradigms altogether. So why do we even castrate, right?
Yeah, let's talk about that.
So that has always been something that has somewhat baffled me as well. So like I had given, because your initial question was, why do we do it on the cow-calf side? But we didn't really get into it. Why do we do it on the feedlot side? So certainly there is the decreased aggression to enhance on-farm safety, right? So dealing with bulls can be more dangerous than dealing with steers. So that is an issue. I remember back in university when we were addressing this topic, one of the things was bulls just require more robust handling systems, right? That was the question that came out. Now, I think the person that made that comment hasn't seen a modern feed yard, and just about every modern feed yard I can think of would easily be able to handle, from a facility standpoint, feeding out all bulls. Like they're strong fences and silencer chutes. And so I don't really believe in that sort of argument. And then the last argument is just really in terms of what the meat does, right? So the conventional wisdom is that through castration, we have the increase in quality of acceptable meat to consumers, right? So we have higher grade, more marbling, and more consistent product when we castrate. That's the conventional wisdom. Now, I don't know if that's necessarily true. Certainly there is literature to support that to some extent. A lot of it's older meat science literature from the 60s. But then we just look towards the UK model, the EU model, and very rarely do they castrate. They're running, I'm active on social media and I have a large following in Europe and the UK, and people love sharing their story with me. And I see these guys feeding out these beautiful bulls with no issue. They're getting them fat. They're super easy to handle. They're just like, yeah, it makes you wonder, right?
Yeah, no doubt. That's good. Appreciate that. A couple of other things that I wanted to circle back and cover is, would you say that a retained testicle is a heritable trait that would lead you to consider culling the female that produced that progeny?
It certainly is. There is a heritable component to it. Is that enough of a reason for me to want to justify calling that mama cow? It would really depend on what type of operation I have. So am I just commercial? Then no, I would leave that mama around. That doesn't really matter to me. If I'm purebred and I do have an issue, then potentially I would consider calling both sides. But that said, we don't see it that commonly. It would only be if you had a suspicion that you did have a bigger problem going on.
What do you think about people who are trying to raise their own bulls? Is there value there? Can people, are you seeing people who are doing it and experiencing benefit? Or is it, do you think that the genetic benefit of somebody else's program is enough that people should be buying bulls from outside of their herd?
I think that building up your own genetics and keeping back bulls is an amazing option. I think that it does take some work and it takes some planning, and you have to have your goals well defined, and you certainly have to put attention to detail into it. But I know of lots of success stories and very good outcomes from doing that. So I don't think that's absolutely necessary. Your genetics are a reflection of your environment, and it's always tricky at times to put somebody else's genetics into your different environment and expect them to perform the same, right? So I think it can be done with great success. That said, I also think that they're, depending on the goal of your operation, that you can purchase those genetics in and have great success as well. And you know, in terms of this purebred versus hybrid sort of or composite debate that's existed in the industry, I think once again it really depends on the operation and your goals. I think at times purebreds can certainly provide value, and I think at times hybrid or composite genetics can certainly provide value depending on what you're trying to do with your overall operation.
And you're referring to hybrid vigor and heterosis, is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, okay. Yeah, for sure.
So just one thing from a HR perspective, I'll tell a story real quick. We were branding one time. It was the first year my dad ever asked me to run the hot irons, and so it was, you know, probably 10 years ago now or so, around there, and I made a rookie mistake of standing on the wrong side of the calf to brand him. Right before I started branding him, I'd picked up the knife that was left on the animal to just get it out of the way. So I was branding this calf, and he kicked my feet out from under me while I was holding that knife that was being used for knife cutting, and I ended up cutting the person holding the calf, and I don't know how close I was to this gentleman's femoral artery, but it was way too close for comfort.
Yeah.
He ended up having to go for stitches, and I didn't know it at the time until he got back from the hospital.
Right.
So it was a very cheap lesson learned at that point. It cost me a bottle of Pendleton, but it could have been a lot worse. And so that's just one thing to throw out there as a consideration. Now, obviously, I made a rookie mistake, but having sharp knives floating around with hot irons is not that hard to extrapolate a set of circumstances where something could go wrong. So just one consideration there.
Absolutely. And then add on vaccination needles, potentially implant needles, ropes, Yep.
Yeah, and some of that stuff you're vaccinating with at branding time is not to be messed around with. You know, I've seen just small yeah. pokes result in emergency room stays and hospital visits, and so not even an injection, just a poke with the residue at the end of the needle. So.
Yeah.
Well, Cody, I appreciate your time today. Could you tell us a little bit about how we could keep up with you online and some of that stuff?
For sure. I don't want to run this too long, but we did miss something that I did want to talk about when it comes to castration, and that's vaccination. So the castration vaccination as a potential solution to a lot of the issues that we're talking about. So I've been following this technology for quite a while, and I'll try to be brief, but essentially Zoetis has a product in a few different countries, Australia and Romania. There might be a few more that it has license to, with a product called Bocreva. So what this is a GnRH vaccine, so a vaccination against the hormone GnRH, which is essentially the start of the hormone cascade. So GnRH then upregulates a variety of other sex hormones, which then causes you to go into puberty, and that's what, you know, then you have your testosterone and you are a functioning intact male. So you can actually there is technology that exists to vaccinate animals against GnRH and have them effectively be castrated. Now, with the product that they have right now, it does require revaccination, so it would be two doses, and depending on the literature you look at, you would get from an initial vaccination and a redose, you would get about 6 months worth of vaccination, so of castration, which in most cases could potentially work. So I think in the feed yard setting, you could do maybe not on arrival, so let's leave the nuts in for a little while. If we truly believe this, you know, in terms of carcass consistency and increased quality product. So let's say we do want to keep castrating animals. You could do a delayed vaccination at about 30 days on arrival, when we typically do an IBR vaccination in the feed yards. Do a revaccination again 30 days later, and effectively have those animals castrated throughout the course of the feeding period. That seems like a wonderful option to me. And that could potentially eliminate castration on the cow-calf side. If feedlots had the access to this technology, then why would we ever castrate on the cow-calf side? The feedlots would just castrate by a vaccine on arrival or however that works out from a processing standpoint. And there we go, problem solved. So a couple of issues with it. A, there's a cost associated with it, but all of the things that we're talking about have a cost associated with it. Calcrate bands are ridiculously expensive, you know, for what they actually are, right? And there is a cost associated with surgical castration. You have to factor in your time and the increased morbidity and increased mortality that exists with that. It's not high, but it exists. So we all have, you know, all of the techniques have costs associated with them. There is a consideration when it comes to human health concerns. So this is not a discriminating vaccine. So a vaccination, we were just talking about needle pokes, vaccination could result in a temporary castration. So I say temporary because they've actually developed the vaccine for it to have this boost for the full effect to take course. They can make the vaccine strong enough to be a single poke, and you would be effectively castrated for about 3 years. There's technology that exists for that. But from a human health concern, they actually split it up into these two doses. So you would actually have to be dumb enough to vaccinate yourself twice with the castration vaccine in order to effectively castrate yourself. But that terrifies. When I talk to feedlots about that there's a castration vaccine, they're terrified about, you know, turning that loose and processing 1,000 animals a day and have this thing in a gun. But I think the risk is relatively low, and I'd rather get 2 cc's of castration vaccine than 2 cc's of Micotil any day. So really, or two cc's of a lot of things. I'd rather take the castration vaccine over 2 cc's of Draxxin given, you know, accidentally. So I do think it's a good option, but I think even going forward, there's some interesting things that's happening. So I'm not sure in the U.S., but this product under the Zoetis brand actually is already in Canada and nobody talks about it. Its label is called Improvest, and they're using it in pig facilities. So they're castrating pigs with this, with, from my understanding, great success. The reason that it's a great success is you don't have to castrate these baby pigs. So from an animal welfare consideration, it's great. But from the packing side, the packers are absolutely loving it because the carcasses are even better than traditionally castrated animals. So they're preferring it. Now, there's tight regulations around it that you have to keep a log of every dose that goes out. You have to take a safety course before you're allowed to use Improvest in the pig barns. But then I'm going to blow your mind even further. So they were loving this product so much when it came to the male pig side that they started using it on the female pigs as well, because you just shut down all their reproductive functions and their carcass qualities improved. So they started using it on females as well. And if you look through the literature, there's some compelling evidence in cows, in female cows, that also using this vaccine does have a benefit in the feed yard. There's some very compelling literature out of Australia that shows that. So the Australians used a similar product. The product that the Australians used was one that was created by the what's it called? It's in the U.S. and it's a national agency that would be responsible for controlling feral horse populations. I can't remember the agency name, but essentially a U.S. federal agency also developed a version of this vaccine that then the Australians were using in feed yards, and they showed that they could have these positive carcass benefits in heifers. So I truly believe that if this came to market, that there could be nothing but upside for everyone. Improved animal welfare, decreased complications, and improved carcass quality that then equals more dollars within the system. So I'm very excited for that, but I have no idea when that would actually come to market large scale.
Sure. Let me just make sure I'm understanding correctly. Is this is a temporary castration even with the booster? Is that correct?
Even with the booster, there is still the body will come back and respond, but for the most part, depending on the data you look at, you would get a castration for 6 to 9 months. So essentially, you could prolong it throughout the feeding period.
Right.
Gotcha. And you could give a third boost if an animal was longer fed.
Right. And so the function is of basically castration and spaying of animals is that those reproductive hormones, basically the body isn't wasting energy on those reproductive hormones, and so they're able to convert feed better. Is that a good understanding of how that works?
That would be basic, but yes, that is one of the things. You know, certainly that's why we feed MGA to heifers, right? We're just shutting down those heat cycles. So it's not necessarily the hormone itself, but also some of the behaviors, right? Having a perpetual groups of heifers coming and cycling when you're trying to feed them out doesn't do anything for conversion. So yeah, you know, that it's a little bit more complicated than that, but yeah, that's effectively, they're changing their mind from ass to grass once again. To cycle back.
Sure. No, I really appreciate it. Great. I'm glad we didn't leave that on the table. When I introduce this episode, I will definitely make sure people know that they've got to stick around to the end to hear the real paradigm challenge. So, so appreciate you circling back on that. So anything else that we've left on the table?
No, I think that is it.
Okay, great. So how could people keep up with you? What are you up to keeping yourself busy online?
Yeah, so still cranking out videos in terms of my daily life as a beef cattle veterinarian in Airdrie, Alberta, Canada. So anywhere on Facebook or YouTube, just type in my name and you'll find my videos on there. And if anybody has any questions, you can certainly email me, and that's cody@codycroman.com.
And if I didn't already put it in our previous episode, I will put it in this episode, the You Ain't No Cow Vet video. That was a good one. So.
Perfect.
Anyways, be sure to keep up with Cody online, and there will be links to all of that at the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/85. So, Cody, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Well, I really appreciate Cody taking time to join me and some good stuff there. Appreciate him not letting me go without that final paradigm challenge. Cody actually has a podcast of his own. I was a guest there on his podcast, basically rehashing the stuff from episode 72, free market capitalism, but some discussion and back and forth with Cody and I that probably adds a little bit different flavor to that. If you're interested in it, I'll have a link to that at the show notes page as well. workingcows.net/85. Also, go ahead and reach out. Leave me a voicemail, 605-549-5401. Look forward to talking to you and hearing from you real soon. And I look forward to next week's episode where we're going to talk about a different way of thinking about bull testing with Glenn Jensen, who is also a vet in Utah. As I said last week, all vets, all the time here for a couple weeks here on the Working Cows podcast. Got some really exciting emails out right now, trying to work out scheduling with a couple of really exciting guests in the future. So continuing to try and put out really exciting content for you, and just excited about what's going on with the Working Cows podcast. We'll see you next week with another episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.